I'd like to take you down to the Dominican Republic during this time we're together, share with you some of the things that happen in our lives that are ordinary, and some of them extraordinary and unexpected. I think life is often like that. It goes on in a routine fashion, and then all of a sudden something happens that really turns your life upside down. Well, we were in a very quiet and ordinary stage of our life. I was busy with a Dominican colleague translating from English into Spanish a book called The Church, a symposium of principles and practices. It was edited by J.B. Watson, one of the great Bible teachers in the United Kingdom over 50 years ago. And all of the papers were written by very well-known men in our church circles. We had great joy in this work, and I spent time, hours every day, chapter by chapter. We sent some of the early chapters over to Spain, to Mr. Ernest Trenchard, who was one of the great missionaries in Spain from England. And he wrote back and very kindly encouraged us and made some suggestions. So I spent my days primarily in this work of translation. Now, Grace had her own ministry. She was involved with classes for ladies and children. And then we had a young family, three young children, and Grace had a lot of responsibility with them. So our life was probably very much like your life. You had your ordinary work, and you had a family. And one night, rather tired and rather late, I just came out of the study, and we retired to our bedroom, and I went out, sound asleep. And I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning that my wife woke me up. And I wondered, what in all the world had happened? She said, "Jim, come to the window." Well, there's not much you can see out of a window at 4 o'clock in the morning. But I went to the window with her. Here we are, standing in our night clothes, looking out this window. And across from our home was an empty lot. Next to it was the International Clinic or Hospital, originally started by evangelicals, but at that time it was a secular institution. And Grace said, "Jim, there's movement in that empty lot." There wasn't enough light to really distinguish, but you knew there were individuals there. Something was happening in that lot. Grace kept looking. I got a little bit weary, went back to bed again. And again I was wakened up. She said, "Jim, come." Dawn was beginning to come up. We looked out at that vacant lot. There was no longer any movement, but there was a body hanging from a limb of a tree. Someone had been hung, and the body was swinging just gently in the morning breeze. We didn't have an idea in the world what had happened. We have no 911 number down there. You called and informed the police, and at that time in our country under the dictatorship, you'd be very careful what you said to authorities. It was a mystery. The man was dead. We had no idea why or what had happened. I went back to bed again, and it wasn't long after that my wife woke me up again. She said, "Come and see this, Jim." And here at the International Clinic, we stood in the semi-darkness with the sun just about to come up, and we saw the secret police bringing to that clinic the major surgeon of the clinic, still in his pajamas. Other doctors were brought in their night clothes, and we knew something great had happened, but we didn't have an idea in the world what had happened. And we saw nurses being brought in. No one else was allowed into the clinic. They stood there, only let in the doctors and some of the nurses. And we looked at each other just wondering what had happened in our city and in our country. A man to be hung by the neck, and now the clinic closed. Something was going on in that clinic, but we didn't have any idea. This went on until the sun was up bright, till around 8 o'clock in the morning, and then the Secret Service men, they just seemed to disappear. They evaporated. The clinic seemed to return to normal. People came for their usual jobs, and whatever happened, we hadn't any idea in the world. So that morning, Grace went off to do some shopping, and I went downtown to the office, and I walked across what we call Independence Square. Now, if you've never lived in a dictatorship, you might not be familiar with this. But there are certain things you never say out loud. You whisper them. And I walked across the park and I saw a good friend coming in the opposite direction. He came right to me and he put his head down and we basically walked around in a circle and he whispered to me. And I got the shock of my life. And I'll tell you about that tomorrow morning. Independence Square in Santo Domingo is very important. It's built around what we call one of the gates to the old colonial city, and it's known today as the national altar of our country. Well, it was in that park where this man came across and whispered to me, and as he went around in the circle, he said, "Jim, last night they killed the dictator." Well, we were left with a sense of apprehension, wondering just what it would mean in our country. He came to power in a bloodless revolution about 2 years after I was born, around 1929. We had had democratic elections in the Dominican Republic, and a respected senior citizen was elected as president. And he was in power only a relatively short time when this officer in the police force decided he would take charge himself. And it was done so quickly and quietly. There was no fighting, no bloodshed, but democracy vanished in our country for many, many long years. And during those years, many sad things happened, not commonly known perhaps up here in North America, but I doubt that we have today in our close circle of friends one family that did not lose one or more members of the family down through the years of Trujillo. If you were ever known to take a stand against a dictatorship, if they even thought you were doing something that you ought not to do, that was not favorable to his government, you just simply disappeared. Remember, I learned that lesson very early. Grace and I were married in 1949. I took her to the Dominican Republic. We spent some years in Puerto Plata, about a year, maybe 2 years, relieving Duncan Reed and Mary, who were home on furlough, and then Ian Rathie asked us if we'd go over to the capital and relieve them, and we were glad to do that. And we arrived in Santo Domingo, into Ian's home, and while we were there, there was a knock on the door. And a short, rather stout man came in. I'd never met him before, and Ian said to me in English, "This is the owner of the home." And we, of course, were going to live in that home for the next year or so, and I guess the owner wanted to know who these new people were. He had one of those jacket-like shirts that fall outside of the trousers of a man, and as he sat down, it sort of came up, and there were two great pistols, one on each of his hips. I'd never seen that in Canada, and I was somewhat startled by this. But he was very nice to talk to, and we shook hands, exchanged a few words in Spanish. He said, "I live right behind you in the other house," so I knew that we would be under his supervision while we were there. His wife was pregnant some months later and about to give birth. It was, I think, the eighth child in that family. And the morning she was to go to the clinic, the phone rang. And this gentleman answered the phone. Of course, we don't know what was said, but we presume he was told to meet some of the Trujillo family at a certain place. And he left his wife, who was about to go to the clinic, and to this day, no one knows anything about what happened to him. His car wasn't found. His body was never found. We have presumed they took him out to one of the cliffs on the way to the airport, and they just simply put him and the car over into the sea. The reason? He knew too much about what was going on. He was one of the henchmen of the Trujillos. He did their biddings, and apparently they came to the point he knows too much, and he simply disappeared. He was not a close personal friend, but we have very close personal friends in the Dominican Republic, and members of their family disappeared the same way. there was a great hatred towards the man, unless you were in his favor. And then, of course, you might be very pleased with a good job and a good income, but many people worked to destroy him down through the years. And Grace and I, as foreigners in our country, we never knew anything about that. In our own church fellowship in Puerto Plata, I'll never forget the sense of shock when I found out that some of our closest friends in the church fellowship were quietly working. Some of them were young women, making bandages and gathering together medicine. They were sure the day was coming when there was going to be an outright struggle against this man. Well, Trujillo was a man not esteemed, and eventually he died unexpectedly. His body was placed in the trunk of a car and brought into the city, and it was abandoned. Many of the details about it came to light only months after the event. But I remember standing in that park with that sense of shock. I knew that for the nation, there would be a tremendous upheaval. While I was in the park, Grace went to the grocery store. We had our first supermarket in Santo Domingo. It was very small. It was set up by an American. And I cannot go into the details today because I'm not sure of all the details. But I know that man was there for a purpose. And he knew Grace well. And as Grace went around with her cart picking up the groceries, he came over and he said, "We got him last night." When the pressure built up, that man vanished from our country. And we've never seen him since. I believe he left. He may have had part in the assassination of Trujillo. But a world had come to an end. At home, a day or two went by, and we, not knowing all the details, were concerned. And I remember one evening, probably around 10 o'clock at night, the city was especially quiet, and we lived right in the middle of the city. But we lived in rather a high spot, and up on the second floor where our bedroom was, it was very quiet that night. And all of a sudden, we heard screams that would chill your blood. I thought the worst had been over. But we stood there and wondered what in all the world had happened. And we'll talk about that tonight. We all knew now that the dictator had been assassinated. We had no idea who was responsible. And we knew nothing about who was still in power in our country. The night we heard the screams and the silence of the night, we had all kinds of apprehension, wondering what had happened. But again, of course, there was nothing on the news. Actually, the Dominicans heard about the assassination of Trujillo through the Voice of America, not through local radio stations. The next morning, Grace and I went up into the area where we had heard the screams, and we found on one of the main streets a middle-class home made of wood, but now it was a vacant lot. For after the screams the night before, we'd heard banging. We didn't know if they were building something or tearing something down. But in the morning, it was evident a home had been destroyed. It wasn't long until we found out that two of those involved in the assassination of the dictator had taken refuge in that home they were hiding. And the secret police discovered where they were. The cries that we heard were their last sounds before they fell dead, shot by the Secret Service. And then they literally tore the house apart. They wondered if others might be hiding in some other place. And in the morning was a vacant lot filled with lumber just lying around. The house had disappeared over the night. It took a little while to begin to put the pieces together, and we found out that about 15 men had made a pledge to assassinate the dictator. They divided themselves into two groups. One group would be responsible for his assassination, and the other group would be responsible for taking over the government. it was arranged that the second group would not move until they saw the body of the assassinated dictator. And that evening, the dictator, as usual, made his way out to one of his farms to spend the night with a mistress. He was not careful as he used to be. The only person that traveled with him was the chauffeur that drove his car. There were no other guards. He'd been doing this now for a long time, and his enemies knew, and they waited for him outside of the city. And when the car came by, they ambushed it. There was an exchange of fire. Both the dictator and his chauffeur were armed. They fired back, but they were outnumbered, and they were both killed. The body was placed in the trunk of the car, brought back into the city to be taken to the leader of the other group who would move to take over the government, but he wasn't home. And there was a sense of panic, and these men fled and began hiding, and the car was left in the driveway of this man with the dictator's body in the trunk. What happened was that the son of the dictator was over in Europe. He heard immediately, he came right back, and the family seized the power and kept it. It went on for about 7 months. But the night when we heard the cries, that was the first time they located two of those men, and they were shot right on the spot. Others went into hiding. Some were killed, not many of the total group. Most of them were captured. Two of them went into hiding, and they were never discovered. And they eventually became leaders in our country after the Trujillo family left. They were difficult days. Everybody knew the strong man had gone, but the family was still in power. And I've never witnessed this before. Perhaps you've never even thought about it. We had no war. There was no firing of shots against anybody in the government. But during 7 months, there was a buildup in public opinion that the Trujillo family had to leave our country. It wasn't in the newspapers, was never broadcast over the radio. They were all under government control. But you could just sense it. And the Trujillo family, they sensed it. And they finally came to the conclusion they would leave. Interesting that the dictator had deluded himself to believe that he really was loved and respected by the people. In the town where he was born, San Cristobal, there was an old church building. It was put in very good condition, and then on a lower floor, a very special compartment was arranged. That would be his burial place. And I'm sure in his mind he thought he would be honored for generations to come. That plan took place long before the assassination. Then he had another plan. And down in Santo Domingo, in the colonial part, we have some beautiful old buildings that go back to the times of the Spaniards. One of them was beautifully fixed up. Today, it does have the remains of some of the authentic heroes of our nation. But Trujillo decided this would be a very good burial place for himself. And it was all arranged. So there were two places arranged. I don't think it ever went through his mind that he would eventually be repudiated by the people he had governed for over 30 years. So when the family knew they had to leave, it was done very quietly. Trujillo had one of these beautiful, tall, masted sailing ships, three masts. You have them now and then coming into New York once a year, these beautiful ships. He had one of those. And they took his remains and they put it on the ship. And all the members of the family got on the ship, except the oldest son. There was one thing he was determined to do before he left our country. And he got in his car and went outside of the city to a rural place right on the seashore where they had a beautiful summer home. And a tragedy took place that night, and we'll share that with you tomorrow morning. during the time between the assassination of Trujillo and the fall of the government, eventually, about 7 or 8 months, life did go on. It was rather abnormal. You sent your children to school with more precaution. Church meetings were held. The attendance was down, especially at night. People were not comfortable about being on the street under these circumstances. And you began to hear whispers and conversations about what it would be like when finally the dictatorship disappeared. But some irrational and ugly things happened during those 7 or 8 months. As a matter of fact, I think today I'm with you because of the quick instinct of grace. We were on a main street in Santo Domingo, and to this day I have no idea what she heard, but she pulled me by the arm, almost knocked me off my feet and into a doorway. And I actually heard, the only time in my life, I would never like to hear it again, that whistle of bullets going through the air. Now, we were not the objects. What was going on, we have no idea in the world, but we just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and in God's mercy, we were spared. But not all were spared. We had a very close friend, a son of what we consider our Dominican mother. His name was Peter. He worked in a small community called Sosua, not far from Puerto Plata. And by that time, there was a little paper appearing in our country. It was called Unión Cívica. And it wasn't an anti-government paper. It was simply beginning to draw lines about democracy, that it was going to come sooner or later, and there were certain suggestions and so on made. This young man and a medical doctor in the same community received the papers and distributed them among some of their friends. Well, one morning, Pedro got up and got on his motorcycle to go to his work, went down past the guardhouse where the military men were, and the sergeant called him. Now, that happened now and then. And often all it meant was they wanted some money for cigarettes or something like that. So Peter just stopped his motorcycle, turned around and came back, and the sergeant raised his machine gun and shot him dead in the middle of the street. And then they went to the doctor's home. He was actually having breakfast. And they knocked on the door, and he came to the door, and he was shot dead. Those are probably the two last irrational murders that took place under the dictatorship. But when the family, the Trujillo family, went onto the boat that night to leave, of course, no one knew about that in our country except a very select group of people, most of the military people that had stood around the dictator. They made the arrangements for them to leave. But Ramfis got in his car, the oldest son of the dictator, the one who was always considered by the dictator to be the heir, and he left the city and out to a very beautiful spot just outside of the city where the Trujillo family had a beautiful summer home. Just in passing, after this was all over, it was left in ruins. And then the medical society, the Christian Medical Society, under the directorship of John Shannon, a close commended worker from our church circles, they set up the center of the medical work in that area. But that's later on. At this moment, he went out there, and when he arrived, he gave the order to bring the men out. There were, I think, around 8 of them. These were the men who had been captured, who were responsible for the death of the dictator, and they were lined up, and this young man, just in his early 30s, took out his personal revolver and shot every one of them dead. And then he went to the ship, and the Trujillo clan left the Dominican Republic forever. Now, when the news got out, I think you can imagine what it meant in our country. There was a small minority who wept. Those who were close to the dictatorship, they knew their world was gone. But for the vast majority, It was a great day of rejoicing. You might not remember, but in Time magazine, there was a picture of a great monument in the town where Trujillo was born. He sits on a horse. The front legs are up in the air, one of those majestic statues. And a photographer for Time magazine caught the moment when, with great ropes around him, and down on the ground tractors, they finally pulled the whole thing down. Every street in our country that was named after any member of the Trujillo family, and all main streets were named after either the dictator or some members of his family, they reverted back immediately to their old names. Towns that had been named during that time, including the capital city, Ciudad Trujillo, City of Trujillo, it reverted right back to Santo Domingo de Guzmán. You might be interested to know we have three children. Two of them were born in Ciudad Trujillo, and one was born in Santo Domingo. The three were born in the same city, but the name had gone back to its original meaning. A town called Nagua originally was changed to the name of the dictator's mother, Julia Molina. The day after they left, it was back to Nagua again. I went to the post office to buy some stamps. I couldn't understand the long lineup. And I got in line and patiently waited and found out not one Dominican would buy a stamp that had the dictator's face on it. And they went back into the files to get all the stamps, and they found some which they were able to sell to the public until finally new stamps were produced. But it was an unsettled time. And I remember once Grace and I in the car went down into the inner part of the colonial city. The streets are narrow and they're one way. It's like going into a channel. And once you're in, there's no way of getting out. And we're in a street like that. And all of a sudden, I saw ahead of us a whole group of young men. They were stopping every vehicle. And I had no idea in the world what that meant. I do know that in those abnormal circumstances, and probably for irrational reasons, there was often a strong anti-American feeling, especially among the youth. And I'll tell you, when they stopped our car and we were surrounded by these men who looked at us, I really wondered what was going to happen. And I'll share that with you tonight. You've probably heard some lovely things, some of them quite sentimental, how missionaries adopt to a different culture and a different language, and they are accepted as one of the people. I'm sure in some cases it is true, but always to a measure. Duncan Reed was adopted as an official son of the city of Puerto Plata, where he lived for over 60 years. And he was made a member of the Order of Christopher Columbus by the national government of the Dominican Republic. But when he died, I wrote a book about his life, and it carried the title, Un Dominicano que parece escocés, a Dominican who looks like a man from Scotland. So you never fully identify, much as you want. There's always a difference. It may be in your appearance. It may be in the accent with which you speak the language. It may have to do with your thought patterns that after many years you have not yet fully assimilated the thought patterns of the culture where you live. So when we were surrounded that day by a lot of Dominican young men, handsome young men, Grace and I wondered what in all the world was going to happen to us. No word was spoken. The hands were put up to stop us like that, and we stopped in the street. And then a man who had an open paint can, not a large one, and a brush in his hand, went to the front of the car. Now, we couldn't see what he was doing, but he did something. And then we were waved on. And of course, you had many thoughts going through your mind, and they marked our car for some reason. And when we had the opportunity, we stopped and got out and looked at what had happened. All license plates in the Dominican Republic at that time had along the top of them Era de Trujillo, the Era of Trujillo. And they were stopping every car in the city. And in black, they were painting out that phrase that referred to the dictator. So it wasn't anything of great importance to us individually, but it reflected the attitude of the people at that time. We moved from absolute dictatorship into absolute chaos. And I don't think that's a surprise. A number of good books have been written about the Dominican Republic covering that time. And there is one I mentioned to some friends today. One of the chapters is entitled The Year of the Seven Presidents. Now, that's not seven individual presidents necessarily. During that time, there were three who worked in the coalition, and they occupied the presidency. But however you analyze it, seven in 1 year would surely reflect to anyone just how abnormal and uncertain the times were. I've had the opportunity of sharing with friends at Park of the Palms, and some of them in your local churches, the story of the penitentiary that took place. That is another story all in itself. But may I mention two things about that story this evening? I was home in my study working, and two Dominican friends came to see me. Now, at that time, you could walk down any street in Santo Domingo, and you would never have missed one word of the public trials that were taking place for the men who had surrounded the dictator. Every radio, every television set was on top volume. And as our homes are built right on the street in the inner parts of the city, you could walk down and never miss a thing. You could feel the animosity and the hatred against all those who had served with the dictator. Well, my two visitors were two close friends. I'd known them for many years. And they came to me and they said, "Jim, we think that we ought to go to the penitentiary and share with those men the message of God's love." Now, I'm not sure if the impact of that has reached you yet, but these men, like any other families in our country, had suffered because of the Trujillo regime. In one of the families, members were lost during that time. And while our citizenship seethed with hatred and outrage, here were two Dominican Christian men, and the love of God governed their hearts. And they said to me, "We ought to go to the penitentiary and tell them about the love of God." As I mentioned, it's a great story. But while we were there, after we'd seen blessing, one day some of the converted prisoners came up and they said to me, "Mr. Cochran, you're doing this the wrong way." That's a great way to speak to a veteran missionary. We'd seen blessings and baptisms, and they're remembering the Lord in the penitentiary. Now we're told, "You're doing this the wrong way." And I asked them, would they please explain what they meant? Well, they said, "Didn't you know there are other sections to the penitentiary? You haven't gone and spoken to the women. There's a section for them. You haven't gone and spoken to those who are in the common area, the thieves, the murderers, and so on. And you haven't gone down and spoken to the leftist political prisoners." You know, when things happen like this, you go into a penitentiary and you see men who've never heard the gospel, never been in an evangelical church, seldom in a Roman Catholic church, and they say they've met the Lord, you're always looking for evidence. Is it really true? And when these men, who all came from the right, who had surrounded the dictator, are telling me, "We ought to go down and witness to those from the left," you knew that God had worked in their heart and changed attitudes. I was very apprehensive about this, but the day came and we went down. I wanted to go alone. But my new Christian friends, all formerly of the right, they wanted to come along. And I really couldn't say no. So we walked down into that cell block, and I was leading the procession, and I had behind me like a halo of these rightist political prisoners, and we came to the door. I couldn't see this, but I could visualize it. I'm standing looking in at this cell about this size with maybe 20 men in it, all from the left. I'm standing in the doorway looking in, and of course I've got this group behind me. That's a terrible way to start trying to address people from the left, surrounded by those who are well known from the right. And one of the men said to me, "You sit down there." It's a little broken rocking chair, so I sat down right in the chair. Well, it was worse than they were all visible, standing right behind. I looked over to the wall, and there was a hospital bin, and there was a body on it. I didn't know if it was alive or dead. So the whole thing was eerie. And I began a short message, a presentation of the gospel. I hadn't gone into it 2 or 3 moments when that body came alive with screams that I can still hear that almost chill the blood. And some of the men jumped up, ran over, grabbed him by his shoulders and his legs, and they held him until he lost consciousness. And then they came back and sat down and they looked at me. Well, you can understand there was just no way to go on and give some type of a message under those circumstances. So I said to these gentlemen, I said, "Would someone like to tell us what is happening here today?" And a man stood up and he said, "Well, sir, that man's been there for 2 or 3 days. We've let the authorities know what is happening and they've simply ignored us." Now, if you're not familiar with Latin America, even after the downfall of the dictatorship, those in mighty places and powerful places, they all lean to the right. They wouldn't lift a finger for anybody on the left. And as I listened to them, I will never forget the booming voice of one of those new converts who used to be the number two man in the National Police Force, standing right behind me. And he said, "Gentlemen, we'll go and speak to the authorities for you." And again, I thought, if I need any evidence that the Spirit of God has changed these men, that was the evidence. So in those difficult times, there were beautiful expressions of the love of God, changing attitudes and doing things that you wouldn't normally do because of your background. I had a study in a garage beside our home where we lived. It looked right down the runway to the main gate and right down the street that went straight ahead out of our area. I'm working in the study. Grace is in the home with our little girls. And I look up, and there's a mob of people running towards our home. I got the shock of my life. Now, we had heard during the hours of the night people banging things, and we knew what was happening. They were invading all the properties that belonged to the Trujillo family, and they were dismantling them. Windows, doors, bathroom fixtures, furniture, it all went, and all that was left was an empty concrete shell. Now, we lived in a home that belonged to the Trujillo family. It had been raffled, and the officer of the armed services that won that raffle was a friend of a friend of mine, a close friend of mine. And he said to his friend, "I've won this house, and I can't use it right now. If you have any suggestion of someone who could rent it at a modest rent, I'd really be appreciated. And we were looking for a house. So they came and they told us, and we moved in. And it was a very comfortable home, and we enjoyed it. But when I saw that mob, I wondered if they knew it had passed out of the hands of the Trujillo family. I got out of the study and came to the house in Grace. We saw them. They came right up to the gate. I can't estimate how many were there, but there was a small mob. And we decided there's only one thing we can do, and that's walk out and meet them. And we did. And I'll tell you about that tomorrow morning. As Grace and I walked out to the gateway, there was a fence around our property and a large gate where the car would come through into the garage. I noticed there was no hostility on the face of those who were gathered outside our place. There seemed to be a sense of happiness, and we were absolutely perplexed. Before really we could say anything, one of the ladies spoke up outside the fence and said, "Do you have any little girls in the family?" And Grace said, "Oh yes, we have two beautiful little girls." She said, "I knew it." So we were still perplexed until one of them said, "The Virgin Mary has just appeared over your home." Well, we were taken aback, believe me, and I remember Grace said, "Well, we would like to share with you that we are evangelical Christians." Didn't make any difference. They were convinced that the Virgin Mary had appeared over our home and that she always came where there were beautiful little girls. So they talked for a while, and others came and some dispersed, but we had people all that day looking up at our house. And the next day in the newspaper, our house came out as a picture, the place where the Virgin Mary had appeared. Things quieted down. Nothing officially ever happened about that as far as the church was concerned. So one day, I went out myself at the very time when they came. And I went out down the block some distance and turned around and looked at our home. And on our property, where there were a number of beautiful palm trees, a tall one right behind our house, you could see it over the top of the roof. And it was at the moment when the sun was going down, and I watched the sun went right down behind the tree. And you had that brilliant light of the setting sun coming through, and the movement of the branches of the palm trees. And people saw it, and they were sure the Virgin Mary had visited our home. It was one of the more humorous, pleasant things that happened in those very unsettled times. The months went by, and we did settle down. There was a lot of false starts. A lot of mistakes were made. We would stumble and then stand up, and we would try again as a nation. But finally we came to the moment when we were going to have, for the first time in over 35 years, true democratic elections. Now, you've been born in a country that has a long history of democracy. You were born and brought up in that type of environment. I don't know if you can imagine what it was like for a nation. And only a very few old people would have remembered the last real democratic elections in our country. A whole wave of enthusiasm captured the country. Now, that doesn't mean that we did not have elections all down through the dictatorship. Oh, no, we always had elections. And everybody had to vote. If you didn't vote, it was against your record. So we had large turnouts for the elections. But, of course, everybody knew the person they had to vote for. Often there was only one candidate, and it wasn't always the dictator. Sometimes his brother would be the president for 4 years. A man called Balaguer was a puppet president for some time, but became one of the great men when democracy really started in the Dominican Republic. So we had elections. We went through the forms. We did this so the Americans couldn't point the finger at us and say, "You don't have elections." We had them. But everybody knew the outcome long before they started. And the power behind every government was always Rafael Leonidas Trujillo Molina. Well, he was gone, and his family was gone. These were going to be real open elections. We had a number of parties, And we're more passionate in Latin America in love and in war and in politics than you are in North America. And in the enthusiasm, unfortunately, sometimes some sad things happen. But even those sad things cannot take away from just the sense of relief. Something new is going to happen. We would be a democratic nation. It eventually boiled down to two principal candidates behind two large and well-known new political parties. We had caravans and banners, and you'd see them all over the country, everyone plugging for his candidate. And the day came for the elections. No one had to vote. Things had changed. But I would say probably over 80% of the Dominican people voted. And they went with pride, and they cast their votes. And there was an overwhelming victory for a man called Juan Bosch. He was a poet. He was a writer. He wrote many story books. And he was known in our country. He became the new president. I think even those parties who did not see their candidate win the election at least have the sense we're now going the right way. And I think there was a unity came into our country because we could now raise our head, we could look to other nations, and may I say kindly, especially to the North, and let everyone know we are a democratic nation. Now, of course, the ordinary person didn't know what was going on in our country. He didn't really have the means to evaluate this man who had become our president. I do remember about 7 months after his election, we happened to live not too far from a large baseball stadium. And one night we could see the lights were on, we could hear the people, and then there was a speech, and I knew it was the president. He was there, and he was warmly welcomed by the people. I think it was probably a baseball game. You probably know Dominicans are fanatic in baseball, and we supply some of your best players here in the United States of America. But the president went, and he was taken to the place where he could speak to them, and we could hear the applause. We couldn't hear the words, but we could hear the applause. The president had spoken, and he was recognized and appreciated. Well, the evening quieted down, the lights went out over the stadium, and Grace and I retired for the night, and as we slept quietly, something happened that night that tragically and violently changed the history of the Dominican Republic. And we'll talk about that. Well, we were sleeping quietly that evening. The lights had gone off at the stadium, and none of us knew what had happened. But when the president stepped off the platform and went back to his car, he was literally taken captive by the armed forces. He was escorted out to the airport and put on a plane, and he was sent into political exile in Puerto Rico. So our dream of democracy lasted about 7 months, and it evaporated suddenly and rather quietly, and we woke up the next morning and realized we were under the supervision and the government now of the armed services. There was a great deal of disappointment. You can imagine, I tried to describe earlier all the enthusiasm for this dream, and it really happened. It was a decisive victory for Juan Bosch, and now he had been thrown out of office and was in Puerto Rico. It's interesting that prior to that time, Dr. Kenneth Strachan of the Latin American Mission, based in San Jose, Costa Rica, had come to our country. He was a very delightful man, slight in build, quiet. But some years before, he thought of Latin America and prayed much about it and looked to the Lord for guidance as to how we could reach the millions of people in Latin America with the good news of salvation. he came up with a very simple concept that is not particularly spiritual. It can be true of any type of movement, but he was reminded that the success of any movement depends on its ability to mobilize all of its members. And thinking about that, he came to the conclusion that he would try and start something called evangelism in depth. Now, this had been used in some countries, but he came to our country, and I had the privilege, with maybe about 10 others representing different evangelical churches, to sit down and talk with Dr. Strachan. He brought to our attention that if we could mobilize the Christians in the Dominican Republic, if we would get everyone involved in some type of ministry, he outlined how we could do this. We could start simply by trying to put a portion of the scriptures and a gospel tract or two in every home in the Dominican Republic. And then he said if we could encourage the churches as a second step to organize what we would call in our church circles gospel crusades. But all the churches during a given time to have an aggressive evangelistic outreach in the local churches. And then to move on to things like regional conferences or crusades. We have in our country, it's a small country, I think we have almost 30 provinces. That means we have lots of political positions for governors and so on. But all of those provinces do represent a distinct entity in our country. And the idea was, after local crusades in local evangelical churches, then come together in that given area and have a larger crusade. And then after a year, to finally have a national crusade in Santo Domingo. Well, we sat and listened to Dr. Strachan. We asked lots of questions. The idea of using television and the radio and Christian motion pictures were all going to be involved. And believe me, there was a sense of unity that came together in that group, somewhat diverse, that I've never seen before or since. And I think that happened because of all of the unrest in the Dominican Republic, the assassination of Trujillo, the leaving of the Trujillo family, the time of absolute political chaos. Then the dream was born of democracy, and we were so happy, but there was still the element of uncertainty that as we listened to him, there was a general feeling this could be the time in the Dominican Republic to do something like that. And so I had the privilege with others of beginning to visit all evangelical churches in the Dominican Republic, sit down with their leaders, share with them the vision, and we never had any major problem. You couldn't do that today. We might not have been able to do it 20 years before 1963 or 64. But at that time, just because of the unrest we've been through, there was a yearning for something that we could bring in a united way to the people of the Dominican Republic. And so eventually there was a consensus and a decision was made. We will hold a year-long program of evangelism in depth. It was interesting, it might be of interest to you particularly, to realize that in a diverse group, you have people from one extreme, you might call them liberals, to the other extreme of the ultra-conservative. Well, we had them all in the Dominican Republic. And there were some questions. Some of those who are more conservative said, but how could those who are liberal sign a statement of faith like that? Well, I've been through this many times. It all has to do with interpretation. What it means to you might mean something different to someone who leans the other way. But I think at that time, we did not emphasize those differences. We came together with a desire to announce the gospel of the Lord Jesus to all the people in the Dominican Republic. And after that decision was made, and we really began to lay the foundation for this year-long program that would begin in 1965 and run into 1966, there was great enthusiasm. I would just like to say kindly, you couldn't do that today. For instance, our brethren in the Pentecostal movement have become large. They are a power to themselves, and they do their things their way. On the other hand, Luis Palau would come into our country in years gone by, and most of those middle road evangelical churches stand up behind him, and you have a great crusade. But back in 65, the Pentecostals, the non-Pentecostals, the Baptists, the Methodists, we all joined together in this common purpose. You'll forgive me for the personal reference, but I was elected the executive secretary of the movement, and we'd worked a lot in it. And just after the president had been deposed, in that time again of uncertainty, where we really felt reassured we were doing the right thing, Grace and I made a short trip back to Canada. We knew we wouldn't be back for some time, and we went back with our children just for a short time, and we arrived back on the eve of beginning the movement. We had a week-long conference right in the center of our island in the city called La Vega. The invited speakers were Dr. Merrill Penny, now with the Lord, but a long-time theologian from Wheaton College, was invited down and by translation gave a beautiful series of studies on the Acts of the Apostles. A Latin American man who would not be known to you from Venezuela was the other speaker, and he was very good. We went right through that week. And then we were going to separate and go to our different homes and begin the house-to-house visitation all throughout the Dominican Republic. This conference came to an end with an all-night prayer meeting. Now, we had with us our little son, if I remember rightly. I know Grace was home that evening in the home of the Shannons who lived in La Vega, but John and I were there at the all-night prayer meeting. And so were all those who attended the conference. I think it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. We had times of prayer, then a Bible reading, maybe a short meditation, some singing. It was a beautiful night. And I think it was about 3 or 4 in the morning, I saw someone come into the auditorium, walk right down and whisper to the man who was the director of the service. Now, I couldn't hear a word that was said. But you know, sometimes you just have a sense something is wrong. He left quickly and the service went on. Nothing was said. We continued to pray and sing and thank God and look for his blessing. When the person came back in again and bent down and spoke to the chairman for a longer period of time, and then I knew something had happened. And finally, the chairman stood up and he came up to the front and stood behind the pulpit and he said, "I regret to share with you." And I'll tell you that tomorrow morning. Most of the people in that all-night prayer meeting had no idea what was happening. They had not seen this person come in and speak to the chairman twice. So it did come as a shock when he stood up and said to the audience, "I regret to share with you that an all-night radio station has been broadcasting now for some hours that there is a civil war in the city of Santo Domingo." Now, Grace and I had left our two little girls in that city. They were quite young. They were in our home and with some very good and trusted friends. But I think you can imagine our own feelings. With that announcement, wisely, the service was brought to a conclusion. Most of the people who were present were not from the city of Santo Domingo. They came from other parts of our country. but some of us lived in Santo Domingo. I went over and picked up Grace and our little boy Jimmy, who was just really a baby, and we got in the car and started the trip back to Santo Domingo. It was an eerie experience. We seemed to be the only car going southward on the highway, and there was a constant stream of cars coming out of the city. We arrived home, and it was evident that there was fighting. We could hear the bombs. We could hear the shots. We found our home intact, and our girls really not conscious of what was happening, and we were very thankful to God to find them and our friends in that condition. 2 or 3 days went by, and I remember one day hearing these things. We could see the planes coming over and dropping the bombs. We found that on our street, just at the corner, up on top of a house, was a machine gun post, and you'd hear this machine gun every now and then rattling as it shot. Who knows what they were firing at. But I remember a very eerie experience looking out the window and seeing numbers of people walking out of the city, poor people, carrying on their head their possessions. And nobody was talking. All you could hear was the shuffle of feet as they moved out of the city. Eventually, the Americans intervened. I was down in the city near the American embassy. That part of the city was quiet. And I was driving out towards our home. It was an average-sized avenue, 2 lanes, sidewalks on both sides. And I saw this enormous vehicle coming in the opposite direction. Now, I'm not a military man. I did not really know. I took for granted, first of all, it was a tank. But it was so large, I actually drove the car up onto the sidewalk so it could pass by. And as it passed by, I saw the white star on the side. And it turned out to be a troop carrier. And the 82nd Airborne Division had arrived at the orders of President Johnson, and they were making their way down to secure the embassy. And then they began to evacuate all the American citizens. And when that was completed, very graciously, they included other foreign nationalities. We had to make a decision, and I think Grace was probably the last one to leave with our 3 children. Now, I'm not a hero. But I did say to Grace, if I leave now at this hour of the need of our Dominican colleagues and on the eve of celebrating, as we had hoped, evangelism in depth, I knew deep down in my heart I would never return again to the Dominican Republic. So I saw Grace off with the children. It was not a good experience for Grace. That's a whole other story. But she did arrive safely in Puerto Rico. And from there, very close friends in Hollywood, Florida, Lynn and Dorothy Conlon. Dorothy just recently went to be with the Lord. Dorothy phoned down and said to Bob Cooper, send Grace and the children up here and we'll look after them. And they were there for some time. But in the Dominican Republic, now with an internal struggle, what had happened was the army, the armed forces, had deposed the president, Juan Bosch. Then the armed forces divided. And the army wanted to bring him back. And the Air Force and the Navy said no. And it turned out to be a civil war, basically confined to our capital city. But for some time, it was a savage, savage war. It was right at the height of that struggle that a Dominican friend, a very close friend, came to me and said, Jim, we prayed about evangelism in depth. And are we going to sit here and see it all evaporate now? And so we talked about it and we prayed about it and we decided we would try and get out of the city and go back up to the central part of the island and see if we could make contact with other groups. And we went up to that city. And we did meet with others, and I'll never forget this, to the credit of our Dominican brothers and sisters, there was that very strong and united feeling. We are going to go on in spite of everything. Now, nothing could be done in the capital city. But throughout other parts of the nation, evangelism in depth began. Now, that's a whole other story. Just two things as I conclude this morning. It was a very real struggle, spiritually and even physically. A good friend, we'd known him for years, knowing the plight of so many Christians in the capital city, gathered together on a truck all kinds of food from the central part of the island. And they went down with white flags and so on to bring food to those who were in need. And as they arrived at the city, why, we will never know. The gentleman was shot dead in his truck. So we had casualties. Probably the most outstanding casualty, the man who was the president of Evangelism and Depth, of the committee, a very close friend, who is today the editor of my writings in Spanish, and in passing is the ambassador from the Dominican Republic right now to the State of Israel. His wife was a beautiful, dynamic young woman. The two of them put their whole hearts into this program. They were an encouragement, and they stimulated all the others who were involved. And one night, they went to bed, and in the middle of the night, the Lord took that beautiful young woman home. I don't think anything touched us so deeply as her passing. I remember the funeral, and at the funeral as I arrived, we were very open down there, not the formal way you do things up here, just a casket in this home, all the friends gathered around, and I came in, and my friend said, "Jim, we'd like you to take the funeral." Now, that's one of the few times in my life when I was not able to do that. But I'll never forget standing there. All the committee of Evangelism and Depth, they were all there. And this young man, the president, he stood at the head of the casket. And he said to his friends, "We will not stop. We will go on with Evangelism in Depth." And we did. And it was a glorious year. When it was all over, I remember a Dominican historian wrote about it. He said it was the year of the two revolutions, the frustrated political revolution and the spiritual revolution. And we still meet people today in New York and the Dominican Republic. They'll say, "You don't know me, do we?" He said, "No, I don't know you." "Well, I remember you in Evangelism in Depth. That was the year that I met the Lord." So I go back and think of the fall of Trujillo, all the difficulties that we went through. And yet it was really preparation for the Dominican people. They put their hope here. They put their hope there. They put it somewhere else. And they saw it all evaporate and disappear. And the good news of salvation was preached widely throughout our country, and hundreds, if not thousands, came into the knowledge of something that is secure, that will never change. For Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Amen.